Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm very pleased to say we have Ben Kiernan on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur. You might know that chimpanzees kill each other. So do lots of animals, but only humans, Homo sapiens, engage in mass slaughter of their own kind. At least, as far as I know, there may be exceptions. This is a curious thing, and it may be one of the things that we call uniquely human. I think we should find this disturbing, and it does raise the question as to whether this is part of our nature or it is some sort of historical artifact. Having read Ben's terrific book, I can tell you that I think it's a little bit of both. Genocide is a regular event in human history, and this would suggest that it is not a historical artifact, but that it is in fact something in our nature. On the other hand, there are conditions which trigger it, and they are under our control. And Ben does a good job in the book of describing, at least in modern times, what those conditions have been. I really enjoyed talking to Ben today, and I think that you'll enjoy the rather sobering interview. Here it is. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Have you? Did you guys have the huge blizzard there in New Haven?
Yes, we've had a big snowfall, but it's sunny now and the snow's melting. It looks good out there.
Yeah, we always here in the Midwest we think that you people on the East Coast are wimps. That's basically the word. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Ben Kiernan today, and we'll be discussing his book, really terrific book, Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur. I read it with rapt attention, and I can tell you that it is a sobering read. It's an important book, but it's funny because I teach a class on military history where I show films, and sometimes I tell the students, you know, if you'd like to leave the room, you can, because this is going to be very disturbing. And there's some things in it that are disturbing, but necessarily so. There's no way to tell the story without including a lot of those details. So we should congratulate Ben on writing the book. So, Ben, why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself, where you went to school, where you grew up, and how you became interested in these things?
Yes, I was born and educated in Australia, and both my degrees are in Southeast Asian history. So that was a region of the world that was coming into Australian consciousness when I was an undergraduate. The Vietnam War was raging, and also the issue of Australia's treatment of its Aboriginal population was also coming to public attention. And the universities were full of discussion about Australia's relations with Southeast Asia, with Vietnam, and what was a fair way for Australia to make good the past mistreatment of the Australian Aborigines. And the first interest that I took in my PhD dissertation was Cambodian history. And I had visited Southeast Asia and visited East Timor as an undergraduate. And I began working on a PhD in 1978 on the colonial regime of the French in Cambodia. And at that time, the Khmer Rouge were in power, and it was not possible to visit the country or work in the archives there. So I began to do some research in France in the colonial archives and found that a French scholar had just almost completed a PhD dissertation on the colonial period, and I switched my topic to working on the Khmer Rouge regime and its rise to power.
Mm-hmm.
So my PhD dissertation was called How Pol Pot Came to Power, mm-hmm. which I completed in Monash University in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on to write a second book called The Pol Pot Regime, which was what the Khmer Rouge did when they were in power from 1975 to 79. And came to the U.S. in 1990 and continued to work on that. I published that second book in 1996 and at the same time began a research project to document the crimes of the Khmer Rouge in, mm-hmm. In that period in the late 70s called mm-hmm. the Cambodian Genocide Program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we should express our thanks to the Australian educational system for having the foresight to look into these Southeast Asian affairs. Of course, here in the United States, we were caught almost completely unawares. Even after we were in Vietnam, we really didn't know what we were doing. But so kudos to your advisors or whomever pushed you in that direction, or to yourself for pushing yourself in that direction.
Well, Australia really does have a terrific level of scholarship on Asia, particularly on Southeast Asia, but China as well.
Uh-huh. I talked to David Day, and actually you may know him and his work. He also mentioned the Vietnam War as kind of a catalyst for this. Many people forget that the Australians were involved in the Vietnam War. I don't know. Americans only think that Americans were involved. But,
no, 8,000 Australians served there and 400 were killed.
Yeah, so it was an important thing. And the same is true of South Korea. South Korea was also there, and people forget that too. So it was an important catalyst. Well, let me ask you this. What was it like as a historian to kind of be in Southeast Asia and particularly I'll call it Cambodia for these purposes, mm-hmm. to be studying Cambodia while a genocide was going on? Maybe you could talk just a little bit about that experience. It must have been very strange to realize that you were in the middle of something which was really world historical.
Well, at first I didn't realize what was going on at all. It was not possible to visit there, and I really misunderstood the nature of the Khmer Rouge regime at first before I began my graduate studies, and it took a while for me to work out that the Khmer Rouge regime was in fact a killer regime that was on a genocidal track. And my first newspaper article I published about that was called "Why Is Kampuchea Gone to Pot?" But that was in the last year of the Khmer Rouge regime, and I visited there in 1980, 2 years later, and spent 4 months traveling around and interviewing people about what had happened to them after interviewing about 100 Cambodian refugees in France, and got a much clearer idea from 1978 what was happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So it must have been quite a shock to you to learn what had actually happened.
Yes. It certainly was not what the end of the war was expected to bring. The many Cambodians expected the war to end, and whatever happened couldn't be worse. But indeed, the Khmer Rouge regime was worse than the war, which had itself been devastating. The war that was raging in Vietnam spilt over into Cambodia, especially after 1970, when all sides in the Vietnam War just crashed across the border and the country became engulfed in a massive era of destruction, and particularly both sides of the Vietnamese Civil War and most of all the United States B-52 bombardment, which spread right across the country from 1970 to 73, and killed large numbers of people, and the Khmer Rouge flourished, and a small insurgent group of several thousand in 1969 grew to more than 200,000 troops and militia by 1973 when the U.S. Congress ordered a halt to the bombing. And the Khmer Rouge had used the bombing as a propaganda recruitment tool to gain large numbers of followers whom they armed and turned against the government of Cambodia at that time. And so people did hope, as I did, that the war, when it ended, would be an end to the violence. But in fact, the Khmer Rouge slowly escalated the violence in the 4 years that they were in power. And it was worse in 1978 than it was when they first took power in 75.
Yeah. Before we go on to talk about the book, I want to mention one other thing, because it is something that historians do, but I think most people who read history, and this is especially professional historians do, that most people who read history don't realize, and that is both create and protect archives. And you've done a lot of that with this documentation project. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about that.
Yes. One of the things that people were unprepared for as well while the Khmer Rouge were in power and even after their overthrow was that they would have amassed a large archive of primary documents, a lot of paperwork. And that's what they did, but much of it was lost. However, in 1996, the Cambodian Genocide Program at Yale was able to locate the secret police archives of the Khmer Rouge regime. And these had lain unexposed for nearly 20 years. Mm-hmm. And they contain 100,000 pages or so of highly probative confidential documents to and from Pol Pot, for instance, and also his top colleagues in the Khmer Rouge regime, explaining for the outside world or revealing and documenting exactly what they had done. Mm-hmm. Lists of the names of people to be arrested, orders to arrest them, to track them down, and so on, large numbers of ledgers of the names of prisoners who were to be killed, mm-hmm. and in one case, a list signed by the prison commander saying, kill them all. Mm-hmm. Some of this information did come out. The prison records came out rather quickly in 1979 and 80, but the much higher level security force archives of the Pol Pot regime were left behind by the Khmer Rouge in 79, and we were only able to find them in 96. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they will be now hopefully used extensively in the tribunal that's been established in Cambodia with the UN's support to judge the crimes of not only the prison commander in question, but also high-level members of the Pol Pot regime. Pol Pot died in 98, but his deputy, Nguyen Chia, is in jail awaiting trial, as is the head of state of the Khmer Rouge regime, Khieu Samphan, the deputy prime minister, Yang Sirui, and Yang Chirip, his wife, who was also a member of the cabinet of the Khmer Rouge. Mm-hmm. They're all in jail awaiting trial. It's been announced by the UN that they will be tried with genocide.
Mm-hmm. I see. So what is the disposition of the archive now?
It's the original copies, which we found in 96, have been stored at the Documentation Center of Cambodia in Phnom Penh, which was an NGO that I established as the field office of the Cambodian Genocide Program. And in 1997, it became an independent Cambodian institution, which through the Cambodian Genocide Program at Yale, we continued to fund until 2001, but it's now independent and self-supporting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Have efforts been made to publish the documents?
Well, a lot of them are on our website of the Cambodian Genocide Program, and others have been translated, but I think a lot of them are currently being studied by the UN tribunal, the Cambodia Joint Tribunal with UN support, that is preparing the case for trial.
Mm-hmm. I see. Is there a plan to publish them all eventually?
Well, it's 100,000 pages. It's all been microfilmed by Yale University's Sterling Library, and copies are available, but it's 486 reels.
Yeah. No, it's actually, I was reading a book just the other day on the military tribunals that were conducted not what we call the Nuremberg trials, but this what are called the subsequent trials. Mm-hmm. And a woman who I'm going to interview in a few weeks went through them, and she described the amount of documentation. And it is truly formidable. It's a lot of – and I'm saying that as somebody that was trained as a kind of medieval historian. So you can spend most of your career looking at six documents.
Right.
So we have a little bit different problem than you guys do. Let me first of all just congratulate you for that work, because it's really terrific, and people should know that historians are often involved in the archiving of historical documentation and the presentation and preservation of it. And your case, I'm very envious is not quite the right word. I respect the challenge, and I'm really glad that you rose to it, because you have now, you and your colleagues have saved this primary documentation for scholars to study for, let's hope, centuries to come, so that these things won't be forgotten. I think it's important to to recognize that for what it is. But I know lots of historians who do this sort of work. They try to create archives as they do their research. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that because I knew about the project. So why don't we talk about the book itself? How did you come to write it? Why did you write the book?
In the 1980s, as I was writing the Pol Pot regime book, I began to think about comparisons with other cases of mass murder or genocide. And I started to research the Armenian genocide, which was one of the major genocides of the 20th century and was a case that really put the concept of genocide into international academic discussion, rather than focusing on the Holocaust and the Nazi genocide. The Armenian genocide was another case nearly as clear-cut as the Holocaust. And it was Armenian scholars and Jewish scholars working together, as well as others, who put together a field known as genocide studies now, which is a comparative field that attempts to look at various cases of genocide to see, in my view, I think the essential thing is to see what's essential about genocide, what occurs in every case. Mm-hmm. And the Armenian genocide was the first major case of the 20th century that I looked at, apart from the Holocaust, in comparison with Cambodia. But I had in the back of my mind also the experience of East Timor under Indonesian rule, where a similar proportion, about a fifth of the population, died in East Timor under Indonesian rule at the same time, or at least beginning at the same time, as the Khmer Rouge genocide, that is in 1975, and also the experience of Aboriginal groups in Australia, some of whom suffered genocidal massacres in the 19th century. And so I began to look at a number of these cases in the late 80s and early 90s, and wrote a comparison of Pol Pot as leader of the Khmer Rouge genocide and Enver Pasha, one of the leading perpetrators of the Armenian genocide. And it slowly became an important part of my work, not just writing about Cambodia and documenting what had happened there, but to see what were the elements of it that it had in common with other cases of genocide, including the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And eventually the project grew into a global attempt to study a large number of cases in history from earliest times to the present, mm-hmm. Including the Roman genocide in Carthage in 146 BC. Mm-hmm. And the upshot of it all was that a number of features were obviously different in every case, and yet there were still some striking similarities.
Before we come to those, let me ask you a preliminary question that I think many of the listeners will be interested in, and it really is one of the challenges of any initial research project, and you deal with it in the book kind of bravely, I think, because wading into these terminological waters can often be frustrating for, I think, especially for historians who basically just want to get that out of the way and move on to the facts. What exactly is the history of this notion of genocide, and what does it mean, or how has it meant different things to different people? I'm not quite sure how to phrase this question.
Well, the word genocide was coined only in World War II by Raphael Lemkin, who was a Polish Jewish jurist who had escaped Nazi rule in Poland and wrote a book called Axis Rule in Occupied Europe, published in 1944. But in the preface dated 1943, he coined the term genocide to describe the destruction of a national racial or ethnic or religious group. He had already been active in the 1930s in a campaign to draw attention to the crimes against the Armenians in World War I at the hands of the Young Turk regime during the Ottoman Empire. So he was aware of what had happened and that there needed to be a legal sanction against these kinds of crimes. And there was the term extermination, which existed at that time, which had come to mean something similar, attempt to annihilate a group. But as a result of the 1948 Genocide Convention, which the UN adopted at Lemkin's urging after the Holocaust. The word genocide came to mean specifically attempts to destroy in whole or in part an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. And it had to be with the intent to destroy such a group. Mm-hmm. So the Genocide Convention requires not just certain acts like killing members of the group, but also proof of the intent. Mm-hmm. The word extermination still is used in international law, but it doesn't require proof of the intent. Extermination is a crime against humanity, and proof of the acts committed by the perpetrator, including killing members of the group, is sufficient to prove extermination in whole or in part. Mm-hmm. And the proof of the intent to destroy a group as such is not required. So extermination is a much older word, which continues to have a legal meaning. Mm-hmm. It also covers political or social groups, which the Genocide Convention does not. Mm-hmm. So there really now are two separate legal terms, extermination and genocide, mm-hmm. Which genocide is the most difficult to prove.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Yes. No, the events that are happening in Darfur bring all of this to mind because we don't seem to know what we want to call it. It seems by the criteria you laid out, it clearly is genocide, but I won't take an official New Books in History stand on that issue right here. But
the lawyers are debating that now, and some are quite clearly saying it's genocide. Others say it could be, but the evidence is not yet in about intent. Mm-hmm. But they're not ruling out that it constitutes genocide.
Yeah, I see. So let's talk about those. Well, let me ask a different question before we talk about the common elements and the triggers, so to say, of genocide. One of the things that you had to do in this book was go back in distant history, that is prior to, let's say, 500 years ago, and to look for instances that looked sort of genocidal that wouldn't have been identified as such. They might have been called exterminations or something like this. How did you go about doing that?
Well, I found the discussion in the early books about genocide studies that began to appear in the 1980s, Leo Cooper, a sociologist, mm-hmm. one of the founders of the field, Frank Chalk, a historian at Concordia University in Montreal, Helen Fine, another sociologist, tended to consider what happened under the Roman destruction of Carthage to be genocide. And I found not only was that fairly well documented, but it was also referred to in much later cases. And so the existence of ancient genocides or classical genocides, like the Roman destruction of Carthage, was important in its own right as a case of genocide, but also in the way it was remembered. And so Hitler, for instance, described the Roman destruction of Carthage as the, quote, execution of a people through its own deserts. Mm-hmm. And so Hitler described Roman history as the best mentor for all time. He saw it as a model, a precedent for doing what Hitler himself planned to do to the Jews. And the importance of this fetish of antiquity, this sort of search for ancient models and somehow legitimacy in ancient cases of genocide was an important element, I found, of more recent cases, not just in the 20th century, but even in the early modern period. Mm-hmm. People who were committing genocide or planned to do it would legitimize their actions by resort to ancient precedents, whether it be classical cases or even biblical precedents that talked about the destruction of peoples in ancient Canaan, mm-hmm. In the Bible, mm-hmm. the Amorites and other cases like that, which may not even have occurred. We don't have as much evidence about it as we do for the Roman destruction of Carthage, but it was certainly considered a precedent that was able to legitimize perpetrators' thought, what they had in mind. And so I found that the cult of antiquity is there in many cases of genocide, where people seem to think that they can do it because it's been done before, mm-hmm. especially in very ancient times.
I think it's important to think a little bit about the frequency with which genocides under a broad definition may or may not have occurred throughout the 180,000 years of Homo sapien history, because it gets to an important question as to whether genocide is in us or it is created by historical circumstance. And I don't really know the answer to that question, but, had we better information about what had occurred, let's say 150,000 years ago or 100,000 years ago, we don't have any really, then we might be able to answer that question. But I think it is an important one to ask, because one of the things I think that's important to avoid is the notion that, I think there may be something modern about modern genocides, but I don't think genocides themselves are particularly modern. I think that's the weight of the evidence would suggest that is true. Yes, there is something in us that does this thing.
I would agree with that. I wouldn't say, however, that it was in us or it was particularly a human response to certain challenges. I wrote the book about the ideology of perpetrators, that what makes them do it. But I think it's also important to bear in mind that genocide is usually a conspiracy conducted in secret by a small number of people who often are able to carry it out by setting up a situation of conflict where it's difficult for even their own foot soldiers to avoid a massive violence, and under orders they often do carry it out. Mm-hmm. But the initiative is always coming from a small group of highly placed plotters who have an idea in mind long before it occurs to the foot soldiers that they want to carry it out. And I think also it's important to bear in mind, and I tried to include cases of this in the book, of people who stood up and opposed it. Mm-hmm. And so every time Cato got up in the Roman Senate and called for the destruction of Carthage, his famous words, "Carthage must be destroyed, delenda est Carthago," his opponent, Scipio Nasica, would stand up in reply and say, "Carthage must be allowed to exist," every time he made a speech. And so there was always a challenge, and it was Cato who came out on top and won the debate in the Senate, but it wasn't easy. It wasn't a natural thing to do for Rome to destroy Carthage. It was deeply controversial, but they did manage to keep it secret from the Roman soldiers, because they were afraid that they would have had to be afraid that the word would leak out with deserters crossing the lines on both sides. The Carthaginians would have found out, and the Roman conspiracy was to get them to disarm themselves voluntarily under threat from Rome, which the Carthaginians then did and handed over all their weapons. And only then did Rome announce, having kept it a secret all along, they planned to destroy the city. And that led to the massive violence when the Carthaginians knew that they were going to be forcibly evicted from their city and fought back.
I mean, I think one thing, and you do point that out in the book as well, that there is a technological moment here, and that is in the sense in which before, let's just take a kind of arbitrary moment like gunpowder weapons, and massive armies cobbled together by states, it was actually very difficult to kill extraordinarily large groups of people. It could be done, but it had to be done in a very personal way. And that's difficult.
And it usually involved a setup so that the Roman soldiers were surrounding the city waiting till Carthage disarmed itself. And then when the genocide was announced, that was when the fight began. It was difficult for either side to avoid it after it had been set up in that way by the Senate.
So you've mentioned a couple things which are common to many genocides, and one is this kind of conspiratorial nature, that they are initiated by a small group of people that are not entirely open about what they were doing. And another one is this notion of precedence in classical antiquity or in earlier times for what had been done. What are some of the other elements that unite this kind of, I don't know what to call it, this genocidal context?
Well, obviously, racial or religious hatred is a key one, and that's the point that is emphasized in the Genocide Convention. But there are other features that are not mentioned in the legal definition that I wanted to describe in the book, and they include not just the cult of antiquity, but also a romantic agrarianism, the idea that people who are not cultivating the land in a certain approved way are somehow not legitimate occupiers of that land, and that therefore the conquering group has the right to kill them or drive them out and seize their land. And this goes, in many cases, applies to city populations, whether it be the Carthaginians or the Jews. In the case of Nazi Germany, they were not part of Hitler's imagined agrarian Germany, which he linked to its ancient past. So it's related to the classical precedent that our ancestors were all peasants, we're a farming population, and so on. And so the virulent anti-Semitism or the racial hatred combined with the ancient model and with the agrarian ideology. And finally, of course, is expansionism. It's a clear-cut case in the Nazi example of genocide, but it's also there in nearly every other case. Territorial expansionism, conquering other territories and accusing the populations who live there, city populations, or even hunter-gatherers or pastoralists who are not settled in cultivation or other agrarian pursuits, can be killed and don't have a right to live because they are not agrarian farmers. And I found those four elements of racial, religious hatred, territorial expansionism, romantic agrarianism, and the cult of antiquity to be there in nearly every case.
Maybe you could actually take us through some of these cases so we can begin in early modern times. Or actually, let's not even do that, because one of the things I learned were that there were these really genocidal massacres in early modern Asia or Southeast Asia. Is that and I didn't know anything about these.
Yeah, East and Southeast Asia, for instance, in the 1590s, the Japanese warlord at the time, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who had just unified Japan, immediately set about conquering Korea with an aim to invade and conquer China as well. So it obviously an expansionist ideology fueled by the new discovery early in the 1500s of muskets and the inclusion of firearms in Japanese warfare made it extremely brutal. And the Koreans didn't have firearms. So there was an order given out by Toyotomi Hideyoshi, kill the Koreans one by one and empty the country, quote unquote. And he talked about destroying entire provinces without leaving a thing behind. And the Japanese invaders of Korea in the 1590s were extremely brutal, and they did kill hundreds of thousands of Koreans. And at the same time, their policy, at least at home, but also in Korea as well, was decidedly agrarian. And Hideyoshi's ideology was to keep the farmers down on the land, and if they engaged only in cultivation, as he put it, they will prosper until eternity. And so the vision of society that Hideyoshi had was extremely agrarian. It was a very vicious version of the agrarianism that animated some of the settlers in the United States, early colonial America, before that in the English in colonial Ireland. They believed that the Irish didn't farm the land properly, they didn't even occupy it, and that the land was free to be taken over by English farmers who had their own methods of cultivation, which were the original settlers considered to be the only proper means of using the land. And they were legitimately authorized, they thought, to kill the Irish who objected, and later Native Americans who were not recognized as occupants of the land either, but rather as wild beasts who merely roamed over the land, as one of them put it. And of course, for some of the massacres of Native Americans, the killers did resort to ancient precedents, including biblical precedent. here in Connecticut in 1637 when English settlers from Massachusetts and Hartford, Connecticut, massacred 600 or so Pequot men, women, and children in an attack in less than 2 hours. One of the perpetrators said, "I would refer you to David's War. We had adequate precedent from the scriptures for our undertakings." And so he was justifying the massacre on the basis of the biblical account of David and Goliath.
Mm-hmm. I see. So I see just what you're saying about the agrarianism, which is and colonialism, I would call it, which is common to these early modern genocides. And the ones that you mentioned in the book are the Spanish conquest of the New World, for example, and these the East Asian massacres, both the one in Korea and if I recall, there's one in Southeast Asia as well.
Several, yes.
Yeah. These once we move into more modern times, though, how is this? How are these elements reflected in, I guess, more modern genocides that the listeners might be more familiar with?
Yeah, the obviously expansionism is a clear-cut case of expansionism occurs in both World War One and in World War Two. In the case of the Armenian genocide, the Young Turk ideologists had in mind incorporating all of the Turkic-speaking peoples and territories into a vast empire from Montenegro to Beijing, as one of them called it. So they had a vision of a legitimate vast Turkic empire based on ethnic Turkic-speaking residents in those areas. Of course, even more clear-cut is the Nazi expansionism at the beginning of Continental World War, and of course Japan in World War II at the same time invading China. But perhaps surprisingly, these more modern regimes also had a cult of antiquity, and I've mentioned Hitler's resort to ancient Rome as a precedent, but also ancient Sparta. He's talked about Sparta as the first racialist state, the way they exposed sickly children to die, he thought was a good way of purifying a race. And the Young Turks also looked back to ancient Turkic conquerors in the Middle Ages. The Japanese had their own cult of antiquity in World War II. They talked about the ancient Japanese myths and their right to take over territories in the world that were inhabited by inferior peoples. And at the same time, there was, in every case, a strong agrarian influence, particularly in the case of the Nazis, but also the Japanese in World War II. Settler colonialism, sending German settlers to Ukraine or Japanese to Manchukuo or Manchuria. Mm-hmm. The belief that the local people, whether it be Slavs, whom Hitler described as a mass of born slaves who don't know how to farm properly, or the Japanese view of the Chinese as inadequate farmers, that all came to justify these expansionist territorial colonialist ventures based on a sense of agrarian superiority.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I find this line very convincing for this set of genocides, and I mean the Armenian genocide, the German genocide against the Jews and to some extent Slavs and Gypsies and others, and then perhaps some of the activities of the Japanese during World War II. I do wonder, though, a skeptic might say that while it fits relatively well those cases, that in the case of the what seemed to be Marxist-inspired genocides, and you mentioned a couple of them, actually you mentioned three of them, and I'll have to ask about this, if the Cambodian one can be included. And those are the Chinese under Mao and then the Soviet under Stalin. These were done in the interest of a working class. And
different.
Yeah. So and there's a certain difference there, isn't there? I mean, again, I'm asking this as a I'm sort of playing devil's advocate here.
I think you're right to point out the differences. Obviously, there was no concern with the ancient models in the case of either Mao or Stalin. They both attempted to sweep away traditional culture.
Mm-hmm.
There's some suggestions in Stalin's references, at least during the late 20s, and particularly in World War II, recalling Peter the Great and Ivan the Terrible and so on, as if not models, at least rivals. And, you know, Peter the Great didn't cut off enough heads and things like that. Generally, compared to the other cases we've mentioned, both Stalin and Mao had nothing but contempt or disinterest in ancient models. And so I think the exception, Stalin is also a strong difference occurs in the case of agrarianism. He was also contemptuous of the peasantry. He didn't romanticize the peasantry, even for propaganda purposes, very unlike the Nazis or the Japanese in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Mao was a little bit more, decidedly more agrarian in his ideology, but again, in terms of the final point, expansionism, I think the Stalin and Mao were less decidedly territorial expansionists than the Nazis and the Japanese, although mm-hmm. it could be argued that they held on to empires that they wanted to control, and the Chinese, for instance, could be accused of expansionism in Tibet, which was something that the Chinese army took on at the very height of the Great Leap Forward in China, which was the most serious massive death toll mm-hmm. possibly in history, where around 30 million people died as a result of Mao's mismanagement and contempt for peasant life in the Chinese countryside from 1958 to 61. This was the same period as the crackdown in Tibet. And so I think you could make a case that expansionism was important there as well. But I think the two communist giants, Stalin and Mao, are different from most of the other cases of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the numbers that perished under those two regimes are so importantly to discuss, and they're such important cases of mass death that I did include them in the book in some detail.
I mean, I think at a higher level of generality, though, you are still correct, because what really drives this is a kind of us and them mentality, where we, that is us, are ahead of them, and ipso facto, we can do with them as we will. I mean, in the case of Stalin and Mao, it happened to be the bourgeoisie or some regressive agrarian class. In the case of these earlier genocides, it happened to be another – what they would conceive of as another race, often either another race or let's – in the case of the Jews, urban dwellers, which kind of leads me naturally to a question about the Cambodian genocide, about which you are the world's greatest expert. How does it fit into this paradigm? Because I confess I don't quite understand what Pol Pot believed, because it was kind of a weird mix of things, wasn't it?
It was. It included a Stalinist understanding of communism and a Maoist influence, which was taken to extremes way beyond what Mao ever did himself. And so I think in the case of agrarianism, Pol Pot extended and exaggerated and extrapolated on the agrarian influences in Maoism, which were not there in Stalinism, but were certainly there in the Cambodian genocide. So even though Pol Pot was the leader of a communist party and he drew on Stalin and Mao, he added another element as well, which was a more traditional Cambodian racism, particularly against Vietnamese. And there had been cases in the 18th century of Cambodian massacres of ethnic Vietnamese, one case ordered by the King of Cambodia in 1750, which led to the killing of every single Vietnamese. Only about 20 people escaped in Cambodia from that monarch-ordered massacre. I don't think actually Pol Pot knew about this, but he was definitely virulently anti-Vietnamese, and this can be traced from his early time as a student in Paris. He signed his political statement in 1952, the original Khmer, and by that he meant the ethnic original Khmer, not influenced by more recent cultural influences, whether from Vietnam or even from Buddhism, but a sense of an ancient Khmer past, which looked in part back to the glorious medieval empire of Angkor, which built the temple Angkor Wat and other vast monuments left around Cambodia from the medieval period. And Pol Pot saw this period as a model, but also as a rival, something to be outdone, something to be followed, but outdone, exceeded. And Pol Pot's fetish of antiquity was to be greater than Angkor. And that fed into a sense of ethnic Khmer purity and massacres of ethnic minorities. Vietnamese were subjected to genocide. Muslims of the Cham ethnic group were subjected to genocide. And both of those cases are now being considered by the UN, which has decided to prosecute leading members of the Pol Pot regime for genocide in those two cases. Mm-hmm. And the minorities in Cambodia suffered disproportionately. Mm-hmm. So while there was recognizable elements of Stalinism and Maoism, there was also agrarianism and cult of antiquity, and indeed expansionism. The Khmer Rouge regime attacked all three of Cambodia's neighbors, Thailand and Laos even, but also, and most importantly, Vietnam. The Khmer Rouge forces attacked across the border, beginning especially in 1977, slaughtering people on the Vietnamese side of the border, whether they were ethnic Khmer minority residents of Vietnam or Vietnamese. And they broadcast the next year in 1978 a statement that there are 60 million Vietnamese, and if each Cambodian who falls in battle kills 30 Vietnamese, we could lose 2 million. But we would still have 6 million left, and all of the 50 million Vietnamese would be gone. Mm-hmm. And so they broadcast this on the Phnom Penh radio under the Pol Pot regime in 1978. Mm-hmm. Pretty clear.
Again, I want to thank you for bringing a certain amount of light on this, and actually quite considerable light on this situation to many of us, because it really is still kind of baffling to me. I don't understand the situation very well at all. I should read up a little bit more. Let me ask you this: how does the genocide in the Great Lakes District of Africa, that is what we usually call the Rwandan genocide, how does it fit into this model?
I think fairly closely. I think despite the fact that there are differences of geography and demography between Cambodia and Rwanda, there are some important similarities. One of them is obviously the racial hatred against the Tutsi minority, mm-hmm. The sense that the Tutsis were recent interlopers coming as recently as the 16th century, and disturbing the pristine Hutu kingdoms of Rwanda. One of the perpetrators of the genocide in Rwanda was a historian who'd written about this and drawn a map one of his books of the former Hutu kingdoms, which he believed needed to be purified of Tutsi influence and restored in that sense. And even territories that once belonged to Rwanda that had been hived off and given to other countries like Uganda and Congo should be restored. And Tutsis in those countries were killed by the same Hutu killers who killed the Tutsis in Rwanda when they were driven out, overthrown by the resistance forces in Rwanda. They fled to Congo and began killing Tutsis in that country. So there is an international expansionist element in the Rwandan case, which is not very well known, but it led to the spread of the genocide to Congo. And there was such killing in Congo that has resulted from the spread of the Rwandan perpetrator army into that country, and followed by the Rwandan government army, which overthrew them and chased them into Congo and has conducted its own operations there that have also been very destructive and leading to a massive death toll in Congo of possibly 5 million people in the last 10 or 15 years. And, of course, there was a decided agrarian influence in the genocidal regime in Rwanda as well, the idea that Hutus were the real farmers of the land, the Tutsis were cattle raisers and pastoralists, as well as being interlopers. They were also not proper farmers and tended to be city people and better educated. And the Hutu chauvinist regime described the Tutsis in racist terms as cockroaches, but also in historical terms and also in agrarian terms as unsuitable for Rwanda.
Let's move on just a little bit and talk about two other cases of possible genocide, I guess. One would be the Serbian activities. I'm not sure how to characterize them without offending anybody. And then, of course, what's going on in Sudan today. Why don't we start with Serbia?
Well, the genocide of Bosnian Muslim men that was conducted in Srebrenica has been found by the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia to have been a case of genocide, mm-hmm. In which the Bosnian Serb army captured and slaughtered 6,000 to 8,000 mm-hmm. Bosnian Muslims, particularly basically because they were Bosnian Muslims. Mm-hmm. And the other cases of smaller massacres that occurred across Bosnia and before that have been described by some historians as genocide, but they haven't been found by a court yet to be a case of genocide. I think it's all part of the same picture myself, and the legal evidence does show that that the Srebrenica case was not the only genocidal outburst, but the elements that went into it were not just the racial hatred of Bosnian Muslims, but also Bosnian Serb ideology and to some extent the ideology of the Serbian regime under Milosevic and others did betray an agrarian romanticism. Mm-hmm. That was very virulent. In other words, the Bosnian Muslims who tended to be urban were not the real Serbs who lived in the countryside mm-hmm. in Bosnia. They were also regarded, the cities were regarded as havens of vice and so on in the Bosnian Serb ideology. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the ancient precedent or the ancient pristine past of the Serbs was also highly emphasized in their ideology that that they had suffered loss of land in the past since the height of Serbian influence, and they deserved to reconquer lost territories, whether it be in Croatia or Bosnia or elsewhere. And of course, that spread to Kosovo, where Serbs were a decided minority, but led to the violence in Kosovo after Srebrenica.
Mm-hmm. Against the Albanians, yes. I always enjoy it when some aspect of my relatively obscure field, which is sort of medieval and early modern Eastern Europe, gets some play in the press. But in the instance of the lay or song of the Battle of Kosovo, I was relatively upset to see the way in which it had been used. This is, of course, a medieval epic. And usually when people talk about medieval epics, that's kind of nice. But in this instance, it was not, because they did use it as a more or less explicit pretext for what they were doing in Kosovo. I've actually, just listening to you, determined that there is one other common element in all the genocides you've discussed that you were maybe too kind to mention, and that is that apparently all people that commit genocide are very bad historians. That they just really don't know, have any idea what really went on in the past.
Right, although some of them claim to be professional historians.
Yeah, no, that's I know all about that. Yeah, so that's true. So let's talk about the most controversial of these things because it's still in the news today, and Americans wonder why aren't we doing anything about it, or should we take some action? And this is what's going on today in Sudan. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that with reference to this historical record that you've so well researched.
Okay. Back in the 1980s, I think it was in 1986, a group of Arab intellectuals in Sudan published a statement talking about the history of their presence in Sudan as a civilizing influence and their right to dominate the region of Darfur, and how they had established a precedent back in, I think, in the 17th century. And this statement of the Arab Gathering, as it was known, expressed a sort of sense of historical grievance and a sense of racial superiority towards the largely African, although also Muslim, population of Darfur. And that Arab Gathering statement was followed up in a telephone call 3 years later by one of the leaders, one of the men who became a leader of the Janjaweed militia, the main perpetrator group, 14 years later. But in a telephone call which was monitored, for which a transcript exists, from 1989, Musa Hilal, the Janjaweed leader later, he was said, quoted as saying that, thanking somebody for supplying his group with guns, quote, in order to exterminate the African tribes in Darfur. And so we have evidence of intent on his part. We also have evidence that could have supplied incentive to act. And I'm not necessarily talking about military intervention in Sudan, but intervention short of military means could well have been taken to prevent the outbreak of such massive violent persecution of African subjects in Sudan. But the policy has not been able to stop that. The United Nations has not taken sufficient action. The genocide broke out in 2003 with large-scale attacks against the Africans of Darfur. And the major perpetrators were the Sudan government and the Janjaweed militia of Musa Hilal. The International Criminal Court has indicted several of the perpetrators, but nobody has yet been arrested. I think the prosecutors have considered indicting a large number of other perpetrators, and I'm not sure of where that stands. The president of Sudan, however, has been indicted, and there is discussion about whether the charge of genocide will be included in that indictment or not. So I think in the case of Sudan, we have a historical obsession on the part of the perpetrators. There is also a racial element, although the populations of Arabs and Africans are very mixed, and both groups exist on both sides. But largely it is several African tribes who have been the major victims in Darfur. And the racial element is there, even though they're all of the same religious group, all Muslims. What we don't have in Darfur is a very strong case of agrarian influence. In fact, the perpetrators of the genocide in Darfur, the Janjaweed militia, tend to be pastoralists. They don't romanticize cultivators who are their victims, in fact. Mm-hmm. And the major impact of the genocide has been to destroy the farms and kill the farmers mm-hmm. In Darfur. On the other hand, there is an expansionist element in what's happening. The war has spread to Chad and Central African Republic. The Janjaweed militias have spread their activities into those countries, destabilizing them. And there is an international element to the Darfur genocide, which reflects the elements of previous cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very sobering stuff. I mean, it is a tragedy that the international community can't, as my mother would say, get its act together to do something.
There's some things that could have been done include no flight zones and blockading of Port Sudan's oil exports and so on.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's a very, very frustrating thing. At least I find it to be very, very frustrating. Let me ask something that's a little bit challenging, and that is that from one perspective, and this is looking over the entire history of genocide, but especially concentrating on our efforts to prosecute people for genocide, there's one perspective that would say that, you know, genocide is sort of a distinction without a really important legal difference. And that is, what we're really talking about here is murder, or at the most, mass murder. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think it's true, but there are also legal distinctions which are important for prevention. Mass murder can be prosecuted under the crimes against humanity rubric, including extermination. Genocide is those cases where it can also be proved that there was an intent to destroy a group in whole or in part, and these are ethnic, national, racial, or religious groups. And some people will say it's equally heinous to destroy a political group or a social group, whether it be an entire political party, which has happened in Colombia in recent times. The Unión Patriótica is a political party whose members were all massacred. The social groups, Stalin's destruction of the Kulaks, for instance, in the 1930s, not an ethnic group, not covered perhaps by the Genocide Convention, but certainly the case of mass murder that many will consider just as heinous as destroying an ethnic or religious group. However, I think there is a point that the Genocide Convention includes, which is that it is even more serious to destroy people because of their membership in a group in which they had no choice in belonging to. They're born into an ethnic or religious group. It's much more understandable, that I think, that that killing people purely because of what they are, rather than a choice that they might make as an adult, say to join a political party, is even more heinous than that. And of course, it's everybody's democratic right to make choices about their political affiliations. And mass murder political groups should be prosecuted as extermination and a crime against humanity. But I think there is a point that genocide targets those who do something that somehow is even worse than that.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I find that compelling. I just wanted to make sure that our listeners, and I wanted to hear it too, the kind of logic behind this. You know, it's similar in a way to what people say sometimes about hate crime legislation. They will say that really the underlying crime is what should be prosecuted, not the intent. We shouldn't try to read people's minds. But I think there's also a good argument about hate crime legislation that says that, you know, the thing you're really trying to prevent is a sort of terrorism, and that's what hate crime does, and it is different than just simple murder. So, I mean, I find what you said compelling, and I think most of our listeners will as well. Let me thank you very much. We've taken up a huge amount of your time. I'm sorry we've gone. I always, these are supposed to be an hour, but I get talking to you guys, and I just can't stop. I want to thank you very much for being on the show, and I want to ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
I'm working on a history of Vietnam from earliest times to the present. I've been working on it for a while now and have covered nearly two millennia. I'm up to the 9th century and one millennium to go.
One millennium. Very, you know, that's a sentence that very few people get to utter. One millennium to go and have it make any sense at all. So I'd be proud of that. Well, you know, we've talked about Vietnamese history quite a bit on this show. We've had, I remember James Wilbanks, he's a historian of the Vietnamese War, and we had Mark Bradley and Marilyn Young. So when you're done with that book, we'll continue our series on Vietnamese history, and I hope that you'll grace us with your presence to talk about
the book. I'll be delighted.
Thank you. All right. Yeah. Well, Ben, I want to thank you again for being on this show. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Marshall.
Okay. Take care now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Ben Kiernan about his book, Blood and Soil, A World History of Genocide and Extermination from Sparta to Darfur. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope that you have a great week.